Okay, I'm going to talk about a strongly correlated electron model for a particular class of layered organic superconductors. And some of this work was done with Jaime Marino, who's also here. This is sort of meant to be a sort of overview talk. And particularly, I think there's a lot of theoretical opportunities for people here. So, so the main points I want to get across is that there's particularly one class of layered organic superconductors, kappa ET materials, and they have a lot of similarities to the high TC cuprates, such as competition between antiferromagnetism and superconductivity, unconventional metallic behavior, possibly unconventional superconductivity. And the relevant theoretical model, I think, for these materials is a Hubbard model on an anisotropic triangular lattice with one electron per site. And the key features in the model, that's strongly correlated, it's close to a metal insulator transition and the significant magnetic frustration. And if you want to learn more, sort of a general introduction, there's this review article, which there's a lot of work being done since then, but it gives a pretty good view. Now, if we're talking about organic superconductors, there's actually a whole wide range of them. The first ones that were discovered were the Beckgaard, which are based on the TMTSF molecule, and they're quasi-one-dimensional transition temperatures of only about 1 Kelvin. Then there's also the buckyballs, fullerenes, and then there's a whole lot of quasi-two-dimensional ones which are based on this molecule, the BDT-TTF molecule. And basically, these are layered. They're very much layered material, so conductivity in the plane is, you know, thousands or even millions of times larger than between the layers. Now, when you're talking about these materials, there's usually a Greek letter that comes with it, alpha, beta, kappa, or theta, and that refers to how the molecules stack within the layer. And I'll show you a picture later. Now, everything I'm going to talk about is the kappa materials, so it's a particular stacking pattern. And the point I want to make, though, here is that all of these are just as interesting, okay? But I'm just going to focus in on one, because I think at least for this material, I can at least tell you what the relevant model is. But there's a lot of other interesting physics which we don't understand in these other materials, too. So if we look at the kappa materials, this is sort of a schematic phase diagram for them. So this is now temperature versus pressure. Now, you combine these two of these ET molecules with an anion, and these are possible anions. You can also have triiodide, and there's, you know, tens of different kinds of anions you can have. Now, what the arrow represents is where you sit at ambient pressure. So for this material, you sit here at ambient pressure, and then you put on, you're in an antiferromagnetic insulating phase. You put on the pressure, and you go into a superconducting phase. Now, you can see here there's a metal insulator transition. I think this is a Mott-Hubbard transition, a first-order transition at finite temperature. And round here, there's definitely unconventional metallic behavior, and I'll give you some examples of that. But as you put the pressure on, you tend to recover conventional metallic behavior. And then there's superconductivity, which may be D-wave. And I guess the other point just to make is this is looking very much like the cuprates, except you're not doping, you're always sitting actually at half filling, it'll turn out, but you're cranking on the pressure. Sure, well, the chemists are absolutely sure. They can basically measure the charge transfer that, in terms of the amount of charge that goes onto the... Well, see, the chemistry, you have this large organic molecule, okay, and depending on the charge state, for example, you know what the phonon frequencies are.
You would want to send this...
I would think so. That would, I mean, it's something that needs to be checked. But whenever you talk to the chemists about it, they're, you know, absolutely sure.
What pressure does?
Oh, the pressure, you mean, how big? Oh, yeah, this is 1 kilobar. So we're talking here at about 5 kilobar, you'll destroy the superconductivity.
No, but what does
physically do? Oh, what does the physically the pressure do? I'll come to that. But it's not absolutely clear. Basically, it reduces the correlations, but exactly how it's doing that, there's some subtleties involved. Yeah.
You said that it's like the coup right here, but at optimal doping, do people know what the electromagnetic spin correlation
In terms of there's differences to cuprates, so as your question is, are there large spin fluctuations?
Right, and what's the length of the residual
electromagnetic? Okay, that we do not know, but let me show you the NMR data in a minute, okay?
Question.
Okay. This is hydrostatic pressure. You can also do experiments with uniaxial pressure. Not significantly, no. It's still very two-dimensional. Yeah, extremely two-dimensional.
And it is two-dimensional in this plot you're showing us, right?
I mean, if you measure the anisotropy and the conductivity, it doesn't change much at all.
Thank you.
Okay. I mean, maybe a factor of even two, but that's not significant.
To understand the question makes it more intelligent.
I'll come to that. Basically, it's probably you're reducing correlations, but... Okay, other questions?
I guess the space position and see what difference you can see in the anti-mechanism.
That it seems to be, although what goes on here experimentally is a little murky, in particular whether you have intermediate phases or mixed phases and stuff. Yeah, that's sort of a bit of a...
But there's a sensible first order behavior, it might be sort of the phase separation, whatever, generic.
There's meta stability and hysteresis.
Is it still high
temperature or
cursor?
Up here there's a crossover, but down here there's a real first order, like the conductivity can change by three orders of magnitude. I mean, there's a big jump. So, yeah, certainly in some regime. Okay, so if we want to look at the superconductivity, one of the questions is what's the nature of the superconductivity, and that depends who you ask. Okay, so we don't have nice experiments like the cuprates, these, you know, Josephson junction type experiments. So it's a bit like in heavy fermions, you have to start looking at power laws versus exponentially activated behavior to find nodes in the gap. If you look at the NMR relaxation rate, it's pretty clear. It's going like T cubed, and there's no Hebel selector peak. There's also some experiments with thermal conductivity, which show it, linear temperature, which you can interpret in terms of nodes. Now, then there's all these other experiments. Now, there's people who'll tell you, it's definitively D wave, but I think great caution is here. For example, on the penetration depth, some of the experiments have power law behavior and some seem to be actually activated. So it's not clear. Now, there's going to be a paper in Physical Review Letters. Last week there was a paper. And these people do this magneto-optical experiment where basically they're looking for kind of like cyclotron resonance, and they have magnetic field in the layer and they rotate it round, and they see an anisotropy there, which they interpret in terms of nodes in the gap. But it's not clear to me, for example, whether they've separated out the anisotropy in the normal state and stuff. So that's an example, though, of a kind of experiment you can do in these materials that you can't do in the cuprate, because everything's happening on lower energy scales. Now, in terms of singlet pairing, I think it's pretty clear it is singlets. The NMR night shift goes to zero as you go to zero temperature. Less definitive, though, is that if you look at the upper critical field when the magnetic field is in the layers, that is very close to what you'd expect for the Pauli paramagnetic limit, the Clogston limit, where you're just basically Zeeman splitting is breaking singlets. Okay, so my view is that it's probably D wave, but it's certainly not a not shown definitively yet. Okay, so in terms of what's the metallic phase look like? It's not like the cuprates, but it's definitely not just like conventional metal. Sorry.
I guess you still have to tell us what the lattice is, right?
You
already announced that it's a sort of triangular-like lattice.
Uh huh.
Right. So what is the meaning of VLET out there?
Oh, in terms of, okay, well, something which had fourfold symmetry, I guess.
There should be some kind of subgroup of the lattice.
Yeah. I mean, when I say D, I'm being a little imprecise. Okay, but something with fourfold symmetry in terms of nodes in the gap. Yeah, okay. Okay? Okay.
Well, what's the coherence length in terms of the
box? Okay, the coherence length. I couldn't tell you if I'm... No, within the layers, it's less than 100 angstrom, 50 or 100 angstrom. You mean what you get from the upper critical field? If you can do that conversion in your head, the upper critical field is about, depends on the material, but like the order of 5 Tesla when the field's perpendicular to the layers.
At low temperatures.
At low temperatures, yeah. Can anyone do that in their head, what that corresponds to? Sorry? Oh, okay. Okay, so I can't see. I think my memory is, 100 angstroms, that order. Right. Yeah, the lattice parameters are order of 10 angstroms, yeah. Yeah, very large unit cell. Okay, so if we just want to look at the metal, okay, what's the nature of the metallic phase? So this is resistivity versus temperature. This is on a logarithmic scale, note for both. If you're up in the insulating phase, you just go up here, and then you put on the pressure, and eventually you come down here to something that's a metal, and then here you've got something that's going into the superconducting phase. Now down here, resistivity goes like T squared, which is what you get in a Fermi liquid or a lot of heavy fermion materials. But the magnitude is important. It rapidly goes up, noting this is a log scale. So once you're like here, you're above the Mott limit, or you're into a bad metal where the resistivity is such, sort of this order where A is a lattice constant. And so the mean free path is much less than a lattice constant. So, all up here you don't have conventional quasi-particle transport. And notice also when you're getting closer to the metal insulator transition, it's not monotonic. In temperature. Oh, this is within the layer. This is within the layer. Although there's subtleties there, just like in the coupe rates, whether you're ever, how well you're actually measuring within the layers. So.
How mean free path can be smaller than smaller than that?
Well, that's a good question. Okay. Well, no. It depends whether you have quasi-particle transport, conventional quasi-particle transport. If you don't have conventional quasi-particle transport, then it's not a problem. Okay. So then if you look at the thermopower, it looks quite, in the metallic phase, it looks quite similar to the coupe rates in the sense that, first of all, the magnitude is large. It's of the order of Boltzmann's constant divided by electronic charge, which is 80 microvolts per Kelvin, and also notice it's non-monotonic. This is just in two different directions within the lattice. Now, if you look at the optical conductivity, then this is frequency-dependent conductivity versus frequency. Now, at low temperatures, there's a nice Drude peak here, but once you go above about 25 Kelvin, that Drude peak just completely disappears. And then these are phonons, infrared active phonons, I don't think they're too important. And then here there's a broad feature which isn't too temperature dependent. And I would identify that I'll come to it, transitions between a lower Hubbard band and an upper Hubbard band. And the striking thing about this is that it's suggesting there's some low energy scale in the problem. I mean, something of the order of 30 Kelvin. Now, the Fermi energy you get from band structure is like, 1,000 Kelvin. So, not that I'm aware of, no.
So what's the Fermi energy you would get from analyzing specific heat and the
A-pulse?
Could it be a Fermi-like system, any Fermi liquid?
It's you can actually measure the effective mass from magnetic oscillations, and it's like 5 standard electron mass.
You're basically saying the low energy Fermi liquid That's much larger Fermi energy than the steam loss.
But there is, like in the heavy fermions, this, basically there's some sort of coherence temperature. You've got a Fermi liquid below what I would say about 30 Kelvin and above that.
Well, in
metal, depends how you define metal. It's a metal in terms of that you've got resistance which increases with increasing temperature. Yeah, but what kind of metal it is above 30 Kelvin, that's debatable.
It is metal, it's a resistivity, but not metal to four optics.
Well, what happens actually when you squeeze out a object, there's a magnetic field? I mean,
And you can, well, the other thing is you can do all these experiments with magnetoresistance in rotating magnetic fields, and almost all of them you can explain in terms of Fermi liquid. So.
You can see Fermi
surface? So that's another thing. These are very clean materials. Just ignore the writing on this. Just look at the picture. It's from a different talk. But if you look at, that's an example of one of these materials. That's the Husband-Alfvén oscillations. You can see, you know, beautiful oscillations. I mean, nothing. Cuprates, you know, you can't do any experiment like this. And this is the advantage of low TC, so you can do experiments, you know, in tens of Tesla. And so you can determine the, you know, the area of the Fermi surface. And if you measure the temperature and field dependence of these oscillations, it's all what you would get with a Fermi liquid. So, okay. Yeah, but this is all at low temperature. Yeah, this is like a 1 Kelvin.
Just metal, no problem.
Yeah, at low temperatures, it looks very much like a very nice Fermi liquid. Yes. Yeah.
But you gave us the resistivity. You really converted to get the sheet resistance with the sun, the proper question.
Oh, it's at low temperatures, it's much less. Yeah.
Much less.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true.
That's for a metal.
Well, no, it's at a low temperatures, it's a very good metal. But at high temperatures, it's a bad metal. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's definitely, yeah. Okay, and that's and that corresponds roughly to the Mott limit, yeah. Okay, so that's, anyway, so you can see nice oscillations. It's a very nice experiment. Okay, then the last experimental picture is, this is the NMR in the metallic phase. This was done by Slichter's group. Okay, so let's see. If we look at the dots, okay, solid dots, this is versus temperature, this is T1T, okay? So in a conventional metal, it should just be a constant. You can see here, it's not. And then this is the night shift, okay? This is the night shift, so it's decreasing as you go down in temperature. But one thing that's a little tricky here, it's not going to zero. Okay, look at the scale here. But that, so basically the night shift goes down by a factor of two as you go from room temperature to low temperatures. So there's some sort of weak pseudo gap. Now, and then there's the Kuringer ratio, and focus on this side, this blocks here. The Kuringer ratio is like of order 0.1 at low temperatures and 0.3. So that's the best in terms of suggesting that there's antiferromagnetic correlations. We don't have a direct measurement of correlation length, and there's no neutron scatter. Well, there are neutron scattering experiments, but they're just not very good data because they're very small single crystals.
But even T at low temperatures is not like a conventional metal of any kind.
Sorry,
even T at low temperatures is not like any conventional metal.
Well, that bit, yeah, isn't looking that way, yeah. So, yeah. Okay, so to me, one of the biggest questions is then, okay, so that's sort of the data. It's suggesting the strong correlations. What's going to be the simplest microscopic model you could write down that might describe? Now we get more into the crystal structure, okay? So this is the kappa phase. So what we're looking at now is we're looking at within a layer. Okay, this is a single layer, and each one of these lines represents one of these organic molecules. Okay, so the molecule sits like this within the layer. Okay, now the molecule, it has a pi orbital perpendicular to its plane. So pi orbital sticking out here, and so you get good overlap, for example, between the pi orbital on this and on this, and reasonable overlap here. Now, the first thing is that notice there's a dimer structure. They're all paired up, okay? And that this, if you calculate from quantum chemistry, the molecular overlap here compared to here, not surprisingly, it's much stronger here, okay? Now, there is, the charge transfer is you take one charge off the anion and put it onto two of these molecules. So there's half a charge per molecule, or one charge, or one hole per dimer, okay? So you've got one hole per dimer. So the first approximation you might make is, let's focus on a single dimer and make that a site, and we're going to look at hoppings of holes from here to here. And that's reasonable as long as it's strongly dimerized, okay? And so, so that gives you the following picture. And like I say, this is a kappa phase. Alpha, beta, theta look completely different, okay?
You can argue that it dimerizes because in this way it profits from the dimerization energy. That is just it.
Oh, okay. Your question is, why does it crystallize in this dimer structure?
Yeah,
I would not have a clue. I would not have a clue.
The suggestion
answer is okay.
Because you will perform this great molecular
orbital. It could be. And apparently there's a lot of molecular crystals that... Right. Yeah, there's a lot of molecular crystals that apparently do dimerize in this way. But there's others in this family that don't.
H2 is of the kind, right?
Sorry?
H2.
So what's H2?
Hydrogen 2.
Oh, hydrogen 2, okay.
Or oxygen 2,
okay. Okay. So then you can go to the following simpler model. So what we're talking about here is each one of these dashed lines would be one of the ET molecules in the molecular orbital, and we're just going to replace it by a single site. So we're going to have a hole on this, okay? So then the way this reduces to is you've got hopping this way and this way and this way. But now you don't have hopping this way. Now the reason is, I think this is like 8 angstroms and this is 12 angstroms. Okay, so there's virtually no overlap between this and this. And so notice that here now you've got a triangular structure. There's hopping T1 in this direction along here and then T2 on there. Now you can calculate these hoppings from quantum chemistry, and roughly the T1 and the T2 are comparable, okay? And then you're going to have a Hubbard U associated with putting two holes on a dimer, and that turns out to be quite large. It's of the order of, again, these hoppings T1 and T2. So it's, you'd think it was strongly correlated, and then also note there's going to be significant magnetic frustration because these are comparable. But it says half filling. So then the basic model then, we've reduced it all down to, is a Hubbard model on a... If you want to think about it, you can think of it two ways. It's an anisotropic triangular lattice. There's your little triangle. Or you can think of it as a square lattice with hopping just along one diagonal. Okay, so there's T1 and T2 here. Now, you're at half filling, and so if U is huge, then you'll always have an insulator. But as you get smaller, that's not necessarily true. Now, you can get insight into this model by just looking at certain limits, okay? Because if T1 is zero, there's no hopping along there, you've just got the square lattice Hubbard model of half filling we know all about. If T2 equals zero, so there's no hopping this way, you've just got decoupled chains, and we know all about that. If T1 equals T2, we've just got the regular isotropic triangular lattice, and we know a little bit about that. But basically, when you're in an intermediate regime, when T1 and T2 are order of the same order, you've got very poor nesting of the Fermi surface, and you don't, and you could have a metallic phase and a Mott-Hubbard transition at finite. Can I answer that just a little bit? Yeah. Okay. It's the answer is it's not. It's not clear. Okay.
It's actually the nature of your U.
The U. Okay.
Is it really Coulomb direction on the same molecule, or is it rather bonic antibody splitting?
Exactly. It's the latter. The Coulomb repulsion on a single ET molecule is huge. It's essentially, well, not quite, they're very large, okay? And so then it turns out the effective Coulomb repulsion on the dimer, okay, if this is our dimer and this is the bonding anti-bonding orbital. Exactly, yeah. So this is the, yeah. So that's the effective Coulomb repulsion. Okay, so just on, you can just immediately draw the following kind of phase diagram. Okay, so this is zero temperature, this is the size of U, so increasing interactions up here, and this is then T1, this is the amount of frustration. So here we're at the square lattice, it's always an antiferromagnetic insulator with Nail order. Over here you have decoupled chains, and then when you're sitting in the middle, this, you've got the triangular lattice. Now, if you do Hartree-Fock or Slade bosons, you'll get a Mott-Hubbard transition at a finite value of U, basically because the nesting of the Fermi surface is not clear. And sometimes you get a spin density wave or a metallic antiferromagnet in the in-between region. Okay. Now, I'll talk in a minute up here what happens up here, because that's sort of interesting in its own right. And so, one of the questions then, which I'll come to, is whether you could actually have superconductivity here. And then what the experiment would be doing is when you drive the pressure, you sit up here and basically you reduce the correlations and it goes, you go from here through something, hopefully superconductivity for the metallic phase. Now, sorry?
What do you mean
reduce
correlation?
Oh, well, this U on T is decreasing, okay?
U is decreasing for T.
Well, that's the question, okay, and that comes to Heinrich's thing, okay. So, the question is, what can the quantum chemist tell you about what effect pressure has? I only know of one experiment, okay, where someone measured the crystal structure at ambient pressure, and they measured the crystal structure at higher pressure, and then they did the quantum chemistry calculations for the two. Okay, and so then they could say how the parameters varied. Okay, and basically, in terms of when I looked at their numbers and in terms of this diagram, you could see some changes, but they didn't seem to be that big. And so that's one of the big questions, is how pressure changes. Because the thing is, and this gets back to your point here, that the effective U is actually this inter-dimer hopping. So that's going to change with pressure, because you're going to be pushing the dimers closer together. It's not like a Hubbard U on a single site won't change with pressure, or change very little. So the whole question of the role of pressure is not conclusive, but I think what's going on is somehow it's driving you this way. Okay. On one of the materials, that it seems to be, yes. In terms of if you see do NMR, you see the line split just in two, which suggests at least commensurate order. But again, that's only one experiment on one material. There's other materials. So that raises the whole question of the nature of what happens up here, okay? So since we're all interested in quantum magnetism, turns out to be a whole problem of interest in its own right. So if U's large, we can map it onto a Heisenberg model, which is going to be on this lattice, so there'll be exchange J2 along here and J1 along the diagonals. Now, you can look at this classically, just look at to get your first idea of what goes on, and you'll basically have spiral order, okay? The spin will rotate with some Q vector, okay? Now, if J1 is small, okay, so the diagonal thing is small, you'll just have Nail order. But once J1 equals J212, you'll go into a non-collinear order, okay, which will continuously go over to the triangular case where you've got 120 degrees. But that's just a classical... No, it's, at least classically, it's continuous. And I'll show you a picture in just a second, okay, of what the Q vector looks like. Okay, so so something Jaime Marino did recently is just work out the linear spin wave theory for this model. Okay, so the bottom line is this is the average magnetized, the size of the magnetic moment as a function of J1 on J2. So here you're just at the square lattice and you get quantum fluctuations reduce the magnetic moment, but basically it's the classical ground state. But then at point 5, okay, where the transition occurs, this, you get a very large quantum correction. Okay, so the, in spin wave theory, the correction, it's finite, it's not infinite, but it's large, okay? There's one soft mode, not two soft modes. So the regular J1, J2 model is two soft modes and there's an infinite correction. Here it's a finite correction. And then you go into this spiral phase, but then the quantum corrections are very large over here. So it suggests there could be a quantum disordered phase here near this commensurate, incommensurate transition, and there could be a quantum disordered phase over here. This is going towards where you've got weakly coupled chains. Oh, you have to show me the paper. Are you sure you didn't do it for the J1, J2?
Yeah, but I don't think it's the same result.
Yeah, I would think it, Schwinger bosons would give you a very similar result.
Is it literally true that the order parameter exactly finishes at the position?
No, it goes down, it becomes negative.
Yeah.
Okay, the quantum, so there's a large finite quantum correction. Okay. So, okay, so then another approach, Weihong Zheng and Rajiv did some series expansions on the same model. And so these are both Ising expansions and dimer expansions. So what the focus on this solid line, okay, this is a map of the Q vector, okay? So this determines where the spiral vector is. So here it's locked in at pi. Okay, but what happens is that the quantum fluctuations stabilize the Nail phase larger, and then there's a transition into a dimer phase. Now, there's a spin gap in here, and this, the Q vector here now is not of the order, but it's where the lowest energy gap is. Okay, and so this is the classical result, and then this is where the Q vector is here. And the funny thing is, when you're at the triangular lattice, it's 120 degrees. They both agree, but the quantum corrections give you a different ordering vector. And then over here, you're into the spiral order here. And again, the Q vector is different. Now, what happens out here, the series expansions really couldn't resolve what was going on. But it's quite possible as some sort of, well, it could be a quantum critical phase, a gapless phase, or it could be there's some sort of dimer order there. Now the other thing is, if you look at the kind of thing Sachdev did with these SPN theories in the large N limit, over here when you have spiral order and a quantum disorder phase, you have deconfined spin-ons. So this phase could certainly be very interesting. But just to go back to what Rajiv said, the one material that actually a measurement's not being done on is, you know, sitting somewhere around here. It's probably got Nail order. But it's quite possible a chemist could make, and it's something I'm harassing them about, is make other materials that would be closer. Okay, so that's so just in terms of the quantum magnetism, these materials are very interesting. And that's something that the chemists, all the chemists do is they want to make superconductors. And so this was a revelation to them, for me to say to them, look, when you get an insulator, save it, you know, and characterize it. It could be something very interesting. Okay. So now the question is, to go back to the phase diagram, is could you have superconductivity in the model? So when you reduce your correlations and you go from the insulator to the metal, is there going to be some intermediate, possibly superconducting phase? Now, there's been a lot of work done on that in the last year or so, number of calculations, these are the papers, and we get back to the same old problem. Get with high TC, you know, does the Hubbard model have superconductivity in it? Well, at some level of calculation that this model does, okay? There's some quantum Monte Carlo calculations, there's the random phase approximation calculations, and then there's quite a few calculations using the fluctuations exchange approximation. And these all give you superconductivity near this metal insulator transition. But one of the most interesting questions, I think, is, what's the relationship between the magnetic ground state of the insulating phase and the symmetry of the Cooper pairs? Now, when you're in this commensurate region where you've got Nail, Pi, Pi order, you get D-wave singlets. But the RPA calculation found that when you had this 120-degree spiral order, you got this Cooper pairing in this S-wave triplet odd frequency channel. So I think that's a whole interesting question that needs to look at, and you could possibly, some of these materials perfectly tune, you know, change the magnetic order and then change the nature of the superconductivity.
Can I come back to the question about the order of symmetry, right? So I can think about it as a square lattice.
Uh-huh.
Right? It should have normal coupe radiation, right? And then you're saying there are these diagonals running in one direction of square lattice. Right? It's sort of great symmetry square lattice. And shouldn't it mean that,
you know, one diagonal is
different from the other diagonal, so that
its
nodal points
become
intertwisted. Is that the meaning of
the
lower symmetry?
Oh, yes, I don't know. Maybe we should talk about it later.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Are there any neutrons?
Oh, neutron scattering. There's a couple of neutron scattering experiments, but it's not very definitive because they're very small single crystals, so the data is not very good.
What the
S-wave triplet odd frequency? Why did it come out? They have a rough physical argument, but it's not clear to me. So.
Who has found that?
Oh, that was De Voccia and De Gotto found that. But that's the level of an RPA calculation. I mean, and that's controversial whether that really tells you the answer. So. Okay. So, just to finish up then, I'll say something briefly about some work Jaime Marino's done, and that's recently, this is the question of just the unconventional metallic properties. And basically, these seem to be explained within the framework of dynamical mean field theory. And basically, you've got this crossover from a Fermi liquid at low temperatures to a bad metal above about 30 Kelvin. And in the bad metal, there's no Drew to peak, the mean free path is less than a lattice constant, and you can get the peak and the firmer power. And this is just like what you're seeing in other materials. So I'll just briefly describe the calculation. So we're actually doing it now for the real band structure, but to begin with, we just looked at where you take the frustrated high big lattice.
So, yeah. Frustration is a 1 over
D of it.
There is no frustration except in the density state.
Oh, okay. Well,
the only thing frustration gives you is
features
in the density state. So what does this have to do with frustration?
Okay, well, okay, different terminology. Okay. Frustration in the hopping, if you want to. Okay. Don't call it frustration if you don't want to call it that. Okay.
So it's just a feature in the density state.
Yeah. It produces an asymmetry in the densest state. Yeah, but it does have an effect because it's frustrating because of it drives the here. It basically suppresses anti-ferromagnetic ordering so that the metallic phases.
Yeah, but then in the particle property and in dynamical mean field theory, mm-hmm. transport is a single particle mm-hmm. property because there's no vertex.
Right, but you've still got to have a metallic phase. Okay. Okay, so the basically the role here of this next nearest neighbor hopping at half filling is it suppresses the antiferromagnetic so you can have a metallic phase. But then also if you're at half filling and there's no this, you don't have this hopping, you'll just have no Hall resistance and no thermal power. So it's fairly straightforward to, you know, do all the calculations. And the basic kind of picture that you've seen before is if you had, this would be the bare density of states, and then at low temperatures you'll have these Hubbard bands, upper and lower Hubbard bands, and then here at low temperatures you have this Fermi liquid peak. But this goes away as you turn up the temperature, and it goes away at some what you want to call a coherence temperature, some temperature which is much less than the Fermi. And that's essentially the physics of what goes on, okay, that drives you from the Fermi liquid to the, if you want to call it, the bad metal. So if you calculate, for example, you know, the resistivity versus temperature, but this is now scaled to H bar A on E squared, which is the order of milliohm centimetres, which is like the Mott limit. And so once you're here, once you go above this temperature, you get rid of your quasi-particles and you've got a bad metal. And you also see when you're near the Mott-Hubbard transition, this is non-Montoin. Oh yeah, this actually, this curve is essentially the same whether you have a diagonal or non-diagonal.
Just what we did 5 years.
Yeah. The main point is that this, that picture that you and other people came up with can explain what's going on in these materials. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not claiming this is a new calculation.
I mean, it was a sort of issue of having a Fermi energy, which is like 1,000 Kelvin, which is like 10 Kelvin. Right? Sort of getting the feeling that sort of two order of magnitude is different. Isn't it so that, here you will find that sort of the call as an effective this in the order of magnitude of the circuit? Like you are in the mass is not so large?
Right. This is actions happening here are the order of a tenth of T1, okay? Well, that's because of the subtlety here. When you go from, for example, when you start with a non-interacting model, okay, and then when you go to the case where you take these dimers and there's large Coulomb repulsion on the individual molecules, that reduces the band, that sort of narrows the bandwidth.
So,
yeah.
But you are claiming that the sort of relation between the Fermi liquid low temperature mass and T naught is within the reach of this deep infinity.
That's what it seems to be. I mean, we have to do it now for the real band structure and stuff, but it all seems to be consistent. So the low dimensionality is not important. And this is another example of, this is the thermopower versus temperature, okay, and so there's a large slope in the thermopower, it's got a large magnitude, and then you can get like a broad peak, and this is occurring at around the coherence temperature. So this is a significant probe, actually the thermopower of where you have this coherence peak. So
enhancement in the linear
system
is consistent with the very low
problem. Yeah, I mean, it's of the order, well, the enhancement, you don't, to get these kind of effects, you only need an enhancement specific heat of, you know, 4 or something. And that's the order of which it is in these materials, yeah. So, okay, so let me finish there.
I guess on the bottom line is that we like to think somehow that the Fermi temperatures and Fermi energies are the same object, right? And they're not, right? It's more of the dimensional stuff that the Fermi temperature can be much lower than what's suggested by Fermi energy expressing the unit.
Well, when you say Fermi temperature, you mean coherence temperature. Yeah, yeah.
Which you can think that you're living in a Fermi
liquid. Yeah, sure, yeah. Yep. No, that's the basic message. Okay. So, just to conclude, I mean, I think there are similarities with the cuprates. The key model, I think, for this class of materials is this Hubbard model on the anisotropic triangular lattice. It's got strong correlations, it's close to a metal insulator transition, and there's significant magnetic frustration. I think dynamical mean field theory does tell you something about the metallic phase, particularly this crossover. But I think a lot of the open questions are particularly about just the whole question of superconductivity in the model, and I think that's where there's a real need for more calculations. So, thank you.
So what does pressure change? I mean, T's or U's, or what is your picture? Well, in which way?
Well, that's, we don't know. We don't know.
Okay, if you say that U is actually splitting body and antibody,
right,
then pressures would increase, popping would increase U.
Well, but the question of which changes more. Yeah, it could increase U, but then it, the bandwidth could be increasing faster. Another thing is these things slide around. These molecules, I mean, just to go back to the these are very soft materials, and the question of what happens when you put on the pressure, what moves relative to what, is just not clear.
Well, I mean, the chemist can do without the experiment. You can move your position
and see what effect it has. Right, and depending on where you move, things, you know, change significantly.
What would you like from your model? So what would the corresponding position?
Increased correlation.
Well, that's as long as the question is, how much does this, as you increase pressure, okay, this may increase, but this will also increase. And the question, are they going to both increase at the same rate? And see, once you start, this is all sort of asymmetric, and once you start moving this one up a little bit or whatever, you know, it could change.
Is there any information about tilting, rotation? Is there any information about it?
No.
So just pure speculation.
That's one of the open questions, is what pressure does.
No, but for zero temperature, zero pressure, is there any information about rotation, tilting, anything about it?
I still don't quite understand the question. What?
Do you have any structural information about rotations of those diamonds?
No.
Or they are strictly perpendicular?
It's known that the crystal structure is known very accurately in terms of where these molecules all sit.
So perpendicular, there are no tiltings, no rotations?
No. They're, you can see here, for example, that there's this one is at a different height to this one, and then no, I don't think they're all always perpendicular. No, it's a bit of a mess. I mean, in terms of the structure.
What is constantly larger than the distance between diamonds?
I've forgotten what it is, but it's not a square. It's certainly not a square unit cell, and it's not also not a rectangular unit cell.
Oh, so it's not much, much larger. So there are many diamonds.
I think there's four.
But if four is the square.
No, it doesn't have to be square. I mean, square can be a parallel.
Even just four.
No, a parallel. What's a parallelepiped? What is that correspond? Yeah. So, okay. Yeah.
On the superconductivity, there are all kinds of general doubts you might have about those calculations that superconductivity.
Right.
Those are general measures. As far as your experiment of using materials concerned, those model calculations, can they reproduce the superconducting properties? Fitting the parameters and then give you a ratio of the gap to
No. Calculations can't. All the calculations basically tell you is what kind of symmetry you have and roughly the magnitude of the gap. But whether the ratio of the gap to TC, that varies depending on which experiment. That's another thing. I mean,
that's what I'm asking. The experiments are not have more richness than what you can
explained it.
Well, yeah, but the question is that due to experimental error or is due that to reality? Yeah. Let's just take, what's the ratio of the gap to TC? Well, yeah. Different experiments give different, with different techniques and different groups, give, you know, different numbers for this. So it's just not, in terms of trying to compare it. I mean, for the theory paper...
There's a number of things you can calculate if you have a model.
Yeah, but it's very hard to, like 1/1 to rule out, different models. I mean, I think that'd be the same for the cuprates. So, yeah.
Can you show in this picture where's the
triangular lattice? Well, yeah, this picture, I'll probably have to look at it compared to this, but, let's see, we've got hopping, this is the diagonal, and then this is going to be the square, this is the square, and that's the square, and that's the hopping along the diagonal. Yeah. Why is it not along this diagonal?
Left to right, yes.
That's because the distance is much larger. This distance here is much larger than this distance. I think that's why.
I mean, you're saying that the space is important.
Uh-huh.
So this is the story. Uh-huh. You told the story about it. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Very different. Uh-huh. But that's not the greatest illustration. Well, what is really in the theoretical explanations you gave, really frustrates physics of any kind.
Oh, okay. In this model, if you just look in the insulating phase, there is significant frustration. Now,
you're still in this collinear issue.
Well, in this one material, yeah.
No, I'm not really impressed yet, right?
Okay. Well, yeah, in this one material, okay, but the thing, I guess the point is more, it's quite conceivable that in these materials, there'll be other materials that will be more frustrated. So, but yeah, it is true, for the one material, it's not frustrated.
You're sort of fishing here, right? There's superconductivity in the insulator. Are you saying that when you would lift with space, that you wouldn't have superconductivity and a completely different metal insulator position, a completely different way of would you say that? I don't think so, right?
No. So the frustration is not crucial. But some of that's probably not crucial, but you are sitting pretty close to that transition to that, if you want to call it, that quantum critical point. And so the question of how important that proximity is, we don't know. I mean...
It's very crucial if you can get to this diagonalized
space. Uh-huh.
You're very close to this
thing. Right. But it could be that for all we know that it's the proximity to that that is producing large spin fluctuations that are producing the superconductivity. I mean, we don't know. But you're right, it could be that the frustration is absolutely relevant to the known material. That is quite possible.
Why is it not affecting the normal state behavior above the solar temperature? Because if you are doing this large deep thing, it's just a single
side fluctuation. Right.
Right. You're also arguing that because of the magnetic coupling, you are close to some kind of
oscillator.
That doesn't affect the metallic state at all.
Well, there's this somewhat of this pseudo gap in the NMR. So the question of how important that is not clear. But yeah, generally it seems that the metallic phase is very, at low temperatures is very regular.
Yeah,
right.
Quite abnormal.
Well, but what we seem to be seeing is that dynamical mean field theory can explain. Right. Uh-huh.
Certain kind of superstructure.
Right. Right. So what you're saying is you think that it's quite possible that the the non-local spin fluctuations could give you the unconventional metallic. Yeah, no, that could be, but and that was sort of at first my view, but it seems to me that the dynamical mean field theory can explain a lot of it. But so, okay, yeah. Well, that's what I said. No, that's what I said at the beginning. Is it? Yeah. That's maybe you weren't here for the introduction. Yep. So there's a whole range of materials. These are the quasi one-dimensional. Everything I talked about is just one family of quasi two-dimensional, and they're all just as interesting. And there's lots of things we don't understand about all of them. But at least I think that these kappa ones. We have the best understanding of. I mean, at least I can tell you what I think the relevant Hubbard model is to look at. Some of these others, like these alpha material, it's all pretty confusing. So.
Is there any evidence of that the experiment?
Well, that depends who you ask. There's a FISREV letter from last week where someone claimed to have mapped out the nodes in the gap, okay? But in this one of these materials. I'm a little skeptical about that, but you can read the paper and form your own opinion. Well, it's a strange technique where they look at these, they're kind of like cyclotron resonance, and then they put the magnetic field in the layer, I think it's generally in the layer, and then they rotate around in the layer, and then so then the argument is you can see the nodes in the gap. I mean, but whether that's what the real experiment measures is another thing, I think. So, but I think there's an opportunity there for some very nice experiments, because the clean material and all the energy scales are not. And nice and low, so you can do things in magnetic fields of 10, 20 Tesla, which for the coup rates you'd need hundreds of Tesla, so you can forget it. So.
Triplet?
Oh yeah, I think for these materials it's not triplet, because of the night shift very clearly goes to zero, and then less convincing is that you're near this Pauli paramagnetic limit. For the upper critical field, when the field's in the layers.
But if that's the case, then the coherence length cannot be deduced from that.
Well, that's right. The coherence length perpendicular layer, but the coherence length in the layer you deduce from the field perpendicular to the layers. So that one you can, yeah.
Is there no tendency to charge
not in this. In the kappa materials, in the theta materials, there is a tendency to charge ordering.
Because these dimers and one relation to dimers is visible. Maybe it's also frustrated in
this kind of way. Right. Yeah. No, in these materials, as far as I'm aware, there's no. But theta materials, there's some evidence for that.
Yeah, well,
let's just
give one part of this diamond, one